Those of you that are the regular Bhakti Riksha group members, welcome. And those of you that are not the regular Bhakti Riksha group members, welcome. And all other living entities, welcome. Here, the discussion has been on Bhagavad Gita and a sequential reading. And this evening, You have books to pass out, or I'll just chant it. Books. Bhagavad Gita, chapter 11, text number 4. So I'm going to stall for a little time while the books are being passed out. What's chapter 11 about? Bunch of. What's chapter 11 of Bhagavad Gita? Universal form, right. Universal form. And what's the universal form? Universal, what's the Virat Rupa? Virat Rupa. Going once. Virat Rupa going twice. As the universe is temporary, it's temporary. The Virat Rupa is one of the forms of the Lord. It's a very puzzling and rarely seen form of the Lord. At least rarely seen as Arjuna sees it in this 11th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. But it's also described in the Bhagavatam in several places. In the process of creation, it's particularly important for the, without all the details, because it would, that's not just stalling time, that's several chapters of Bhagavatam. It's essential. The universal form is essential for the creation of the universe because it's the universal form. And for the conglomerate of senses that have been manifest by the Supreme Lord, the elements of creation, for them to be functional, the Virat Rupa has to be manifest, and the Virat Rupa is the demigods pray. This is in the third canto, described by Lord Kapila Dev. The demigods pray for the Supreme Lord to enable them to do their service. They feel they don't have sufficient knowledge and they don't have sufficient strength. And so, hearing their prayer, the Lord manifests the Virat Rupa. And then, sequentially, the elements become energized by the presence of the Virat Rupa. The universal elements become energized. And which means, the converse is, for the withdrawal of the universal form is withdrawn. So here is not creating of a universe, it's fulfilling a desire or a prayer, a request of Arjuna for Krishna to show the universal form, and so he does. And that's what chapter 11 is. So now everybody has a book. And we're going to read text number 4. If you don't have a book, look on with somebody that does have a book. Unless you already know the verse. Okay. Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya. Manyase yadi tach chakyam, maya drashtam iti prabho, yogeshwarat tom etvam, darshayat manam avyayam, manyase yadi tach chakyam, maya drashtam iti prabho. kurotato metvam darshayat manam avyayam. Manyase, you think, yadi, if, tat, that, shakyam, is able, maya, by me, drashtam, to be seen, iti, thus, prabho, O Lord, yoga ishvara, of all mystic power. Tattaha, then, may, unto me, tvam, you, darshaya, show, atmanam, yourself, avyayam, eternal. Translation, if you think that I am able to behold your cosmic form, O my Lord, O Master of mystic power, then kindly show me that unlimited universal self. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. It is said that one can neither see, hear, understand, nor perceive the Supreme Lord Krishna by the material senses. But if one is engaged in loving transcendental service to the Lord from the beginning, then one can see the Lord by revelation. Every living entity is only a spiritual spark. Therefore, it is not possible to see or to understand the Supreme Lord. Arjuna, as a devotee, does not depend on his speculative strength. Rather, he admits his limitations as a living entity and acknowledges Krishna's inestimable position. Arjuna could understand that for a living entity, it is not possible to understand the unlimited, infinite. If the infinite reveals himself, then it is possible to understand the nature of the infinite by the grace of the infinite. The word yogeshwara is also very significant here because the Lord has inconceivable power. If he likes, he can reveal himself by his grace, although he is unlimited. Therefore, Arjuna pleads for the inconceivable grace of Krishna. He does not give Krishna orders. Krishna is not obliged to reveal himself unless one surrenders fully in Krishna consciousness and engages in devotional service. Thus, it is not possible for persons who depend on the strength of their mental speculations to see Krishna. Prabhupada has a very expert way of driving home a point. He says it 16 different ways in one little purport, just in case you didn't get it the first 15 times. It doesn't sound like he's saying the same thing over and over again, but he's saying the same thing over and over again from different angles or different perspectives. The ability to see Krishna comes from Krishna. The ability to do anything comes from Krishna. So, when it comes to the unlimited, it's very logical that the limited cannot know the unlimited. That's very reasonable, right? Limited cannot know the unlimited. Even to know something of the unlimited, it depends upon the unlimited showing some special mercy. Well, there are persons that don't understand that, or more specifically, they don't want to understand that, and so they don't understand that. And they think that by their limited power, they can disclose the unlimited. Prabhupada gives a very simple example. Looking for the sun by the use of a, you say in India, torch. We say in America, flashlight. Looking for the sun with a flashlight. That's not how you find the sun. The sun discloses itself. If you find something with your flashlight, know that that's not the sun. Whatever that is. So the procedure is not this ascending process. It's the descending process. And Arjuna understands that. And that's the point of emphasis of the purport. Arjuna understands that, and he has the qualification. Although, prior to this, he's understood Krishna, but he hasn't seen the universal form. How is it that he has understood Krishna? It's from the 10th chapter, the opulences of the Absolute. Krishna reveals himself explicitly. He starts in the unfolding of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna starts speaking about himself in chapter 4. Prior to chapter 4, he's speaking about the process of yoga, karma yoga, sankhya yoga, buddhi yoga, karma yoga. But what's the goal of all these yogas? The goal is to know him, so he starts to disclose himself in chapter 4. In a number of different ways. One of them, in relation to creation, he speaks about the four divisions of social orders. Chatravarnamayashrishtam guna karma vibhagasha. Krishna creates it. But then Krishna turns around after saying he creates it. He says, and yet, behold, I'm the non-doer. I do, but I don't do. Which sounds like double talk. Mm-hmm. I did it, but I didn't do it. Because he does it in a way that's different than we do it. In that sense, he doesn't do it. He does through the agency of his potencies, and that's how he does it. And far as what Krishna himself does, he doesn't do it. It's his potencies that do it. He wills it, and it happens. But it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen in a way that God's not involved. That it happens in such a way he doesn't have to be involved. That is to say, he wills, and his energies that know perfectly how to carry out his will, they carry out his will. It's something like I just described earlier. From the third canto of Bhagavatam, where in the process of creation, it's Maitreya speaking to Vidura, and Vidura wants to know, how does he do it? How does he create? What's the relationship between all things and God, between the living entities and the bodies that they have and God? How does all of this work? He's not, Vidura is vastly learned. Not only scripturally learned, he's the amongst the Kauravas most wise, along with Bhishma Dev and Drona. Vidura is one of the principal ministers or advisors of the whole Kuru kingdom. Superlatively intelligent. So when he's asking these questions of Maitreya, it's not like he just wants some information. Maybe he's double checking to see if he heard it right the first time, or the person that explained it the first time didn't make a boo-boo. They got it right. And so that's not it. He wants the realization. He wants Maitreya to pass. That's just a sincere jigyasu shreya uttama, a sincere individual that wants to know the truth, wants the realization of that truth. So the manifesting of the Virat Rupa is not something he directly asked about. He's asking how it happens. And now here, Arjuna, he's also asking, but he's asking that the inquisitiveness is because he knows that Krishna is God. Here he's identifying him as Yogeshwara, master of mystic power. And it's not just friendly. Oh, Yogeshwara, you're a very mystical person. He recognizes, because he heard from Krishna describe, Aham sarvasya prabhavo matak sarvam pravartate iti matva pajante mam buddha bhava samanvita. He's heard from Krishna that Krishna is the source of everything. So he knows that. He knows Krishna's position. He declares Krishna's position after hearing these wonderful verses in the 10th chapter. Param Brahma, Param Davam, Pavitram Paramam Bhavan, Purusham Shashvatam Divyam. He understands Krishna's position. Commonly we hear Prabhupada speak about having understood Krishna's position, Arjuna wanted to check people that may in the future say that they're God by asking him, okay, if you're God, can you show your universal form? Okay, if you're God, can you lift Govardhan Hill? Mm-hmm. Let's see you lift Govardhan Hill. And in order to see the universal form, see Krishna in any form, there is mercy of the Supreme Lord that's required. That's the message, the main message in the purport. But supposing someone is not qualified. Krishna showed his universal form on the battlefield of Kurukshetra. We don't know, there's no statement whether others besides Arjuna and of course Sanjaya, because he was narrating to Dhritarashtra what was happening in the dialogue between Krishna and Arjuna. So Sanjaya, although he was even remote, he just saw it on transcendental television. Prabhupada speaks of that, his mystic power to be able to see something in a distant place. He saw within his heart and narrated to Dhritarashtra. So at least those two, but it's nothing is said about the others. But there's another situation, this is now Mahabharata story time, where Krishna also showed his partial universal form. Right? 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 Good. Do you know how that happened? Do you know the circumstance that it happened? This is what happens when you sit in the front seat, you get questions. It's okay. Do you remember? It was in the royal palace, and the Pandavas had a Pandava conference. They had a little gathering and they were very unhappy, especially Yudhisthira, about the consequences of this battle. Although they were entitled to the throne, they were far from eager to be the cause of a battle or be instruments in a battle. But they have their Kshatriya Dharma. Beside the code of chivalry, they have their dharma, where they need something, that the way of a kshatriya's maintenance is by the indication of their title. Kshatriya, they deliver from hurt or harm. They give protection. So their duty is to give protection, and for those who they protect, they're given some tax. And the tax is their means of sustenance. That's how a kshatriya is maintained. Vaishya through Krishi Goraksha, through production of grains and protection of cows and commerce, trade and business. That's the Vaishya's activity. The Brahmana's activity, so many times Prabhupada described, patan, yajan, dhan, patigraha. They study the scriptures, they teach the scriptures, they engage in deity worship, they teach others to engage in deity worship, how to do that. They receive charity and they give in charity. This is their occupation. That's what scripture described that Brahmins do. So if they're as Kshatriyas, they had two choices: to fight for a kingdom or to accept some little kingdom voluntarily given. So Krishna went on a peace mission. There's a whole chapter in Mahabharata describing, fantastic chapter. Krishna comes with his royal chariots and large assembly of ministers and is received with great honor and dignity, and Dhritarashtra gives him a special seat, a jeweled, studded throne seated by his side. And when Krishna comes, great rishis come. Narada comes and Parashuram comes and so many qualified saintly persons. And Krishna indicates they should be given proper seats. We can't be seated while they're standing. We have to have a little time out to receive our guests properly. And after everyone is seated, then Krishna began speaking. I've come with a one sentence statement. I've come to request peace. Let there not be fighting between the two cousin brothers. Let things be settled peacefully. That's my one mission. And in so many ways he described the situation and appealed to, he was speaking to Dhritarashtra and appealing to Dhritarashtra, please don't make a decision that will bring ruination of your dynasty. Speaking of virtue and vice and the proper thing and the improper thing and so on. After he spoke, Parashuram spoke and said everything that he said was right. Then told an example of one king, you get the king's name, who was very powerful. And you know what happens with when you're really powerful and you're not pure in heart. Become proud. Or it's even, don't have to be powerful. Here's the equation. The fruits of piety plus, you know this one, an impure heart equals pride. So the simple solution is just be impious, right? Then you don't have the fruits of piety. But even impious people, they have something and they're proud of that something. So the fruits of piety plus an impure heart equals pride. So this king, Parashuram describes a king that was very, very proud, a great warrior. So he was looking for a suitable match and he heard Naranarayan, they're very powerful. So he went to Naranarayan and I challenge you to a fight. They were engaged in asceticism. It was, you know, please go away. We're engaged in asceticism. We're engaged in our austerities. No, I want a fight. Stop your austerities and give me a fight. Okay, you're insisting. They several times said, please stop this. And he wouldn't. Bring your entire armies and we'll give you what you're looking for. They brought the entire army. And Nara, which is none other than Arjuna, because this is what Parashuram is going to say. He just took a small amount of grass and tossed a small amount of grass in the direction of the king. And all the grass turned into arrows and lances and shot and destroyed his entire army. And the proud king And Narayan didn't have to do anything. So what to speak of the power of Narayan? And Parashuram says, and Arjuna and Krishna are none different than Nara and Narayan. Duryodhana, you're making the wrong decision. You'll be destroyed. And like the king, his whole army will be also destroyed. The whole Kuru dynasty will be destroyed. Don't do this. Who's giving him advice? And then another king gave another story of another king, another sage gave another story of another king that was very powerful and very proud. You know, it's him. It's Duryodhana. He was powerful and very proud. And he brought about his destruction. And Duryodhana wasn't fazed at all. He was just, wishing they would stop talking. Get on with it. Let's get on with the battle. And different, Bhishma Dev stood. Krishna said, can anybody in this assembly speak in favor of what Duryodhana's position is? And Dhritarashtra spoke against it. Bhishma Dev, Drona, and Vidura spoke against him. And finally, Duryodhana stood up and, sputtered, and he was so angry, saying, I don't know what all you people are talking about. My father is as much the inheritor of the throne as Pandu, and I, as his son, am as much the inheritor of the throne as the Pandavas. And the Pandavas have lost in a gambling match. They lost the kingdom. There was this contention. They lost. We won. They're out of here. So don't give me this business of, you're violating religious principle. That was, he didn't use that kind of exact language, but that was his message. He was very determined, stubborn, fool. And Krishna called him, you're a fool. He directly spoke like that, you're a fool. So be it. And Duryodhana stormed out of the assembly, because even his own Dushasana said, I think Krishna's right. I think we should not have this battle and everyone gets destroyed. We should just let them have the kingdom. Dushasana. His legs got a little wobbly. So Duryodhana left the assembly and his brothers and other ministers joined him. And he said, Krishna's a good speaker. He's mesmerizing everyone and they're becoming convinced. And before my blind father gives away everything, we should go back and try to capture Krishna. And if we capture Krishna, well, here's what's going to happen. The Pandavas, they'll become discouraged. Oh, Krishna was captured. And they won't fight as strongly. They'll just cave in and give up. And supposing we can't capture Krishna, we have nothing to lose because we're going to lose it all anyway. It was his calculation. Just like Hiranyakashipu calculating. Well, if you can't make me immortal, then promise me I can't die this way and that way. Let me make my unlimited series of adjustments and plans and I'll become perfect, powerful, and happy. This is exactly as it's described in the Divine and Demoniac chapter of Bhagavad Gita. So, Karna didn't agree. He said, this is a bad plan. I'll go with you. I'm your friend. I'll go with you. You can't capture Keshava. It's not going to happen. So, don't even try. I don't think it's an advisable plan. But so, I'll go with you. So they all went back in. And as he came back in, Gandhari was just finishing. She was prepared to speak to him. Dhritarashtra said, I can't convince him. Maybe Gandhari, the ascetic, can convince him. She's very powerful. She couldn't convince him. Then Krishna spoke again, and Duryodhana couldn't take it. And then Vidura spoke again. I'm going to read just a little bit from Mahabharata. So the description of the partial universal form as described before Krishna showed the universal form to Arjuna. Vidura clearly remembering how the Kurus had violated Draupadi, he could not stand the thought of Krishna receiving similar treatment in the same hall. They had figured out when Duryodhana had left, he's up to something. He took all of his soldiers with him. He's up to something. He's going to try to capture Krishna. They figured it out. He's pretty easy to figure out. So Vidura said, "Oh Bharata, listen. As I remind you once more of the many demons who have tried and failed to overpower Krishna, the hugely powerful Naraka, who is the son of the earth goddess herself, lived for thousands of years surrounded by his vast forces. Krishna killed him easily. He also destroyed the five-headed Mura, who struck fear into the hearts of the gods. When he was a child, he killed Putana and the evil wizard Arishta and Dhenuka. When he was only 7 years old, he held Govardhan aloft with one hand. Vidura named many other asuras and kings who Krishna had defeated. Finally, he said, Krishna is the doer of everything. He is the cause of all causes. From him comes all power. What Arjuna has understood in the previous chapter, to this 11th chapter. He can do anything without the least effort. Oh, Duryodhana, you do not understand Govinda. His prowess is incomparable. And it will reduce you and your followers to ashes. Attempting to take him prisoner is ludicrous. Then Krishna spoke, looking right at Duryodhana. Oh, Kaurava, out of folly you think me to be alone and vulnerable. Oh, one of small intellect. Now see as I show you the truth. Here are all the Pandavas, the Vrishnis, and the Andakas. Here too are the gods, the Adityas, Rudras, Vasus, and great rishis. Duryodhana could take it no more. He jumped up and pointed at Krishna. Seize him now! At once his soldiers began running into the hall from all its entrances with swords and bows at the ready. They closed in on Krishna. Krishna laughed. And as he did, his body suddenly flashed like lightning. He began to grow in size, and various gods issued from him. Brahma sprang from his forehead and Shiva from his chest. The Lokapala sat on his arms and Agni appeared from his mouth. Then Indra and the Maruts appeared along with the hosts of the Gandharvas, Yakshas, and Rakshasas. From his two eyes came Balaram and Arjuna, who stood on his left and right sides. Behind him stood Yudhisthira, Bhima, and the twins. And behind them were the Vrishnis and Andakas headed by Pradyumna. Krishna's mace, disc, club, and weapons appeared blazing brilliantly. His pores emanated light, sparks, and clouds of smoke. Pretty fascinating, huh? Quite a show. The sight was too frightening. Almost everyone in the assembly closed their eyes. Only Bhishma, Drona, Vidura, and Sanjaya were able to look upon Krishna as he manifested his universal form. The rishis also gazed upon him, folding their palms and offering prayers. The sky resounded with celestial drums and flowers showered from the heavens into the hall. Sanjaya described the events to Dhritarashtra, who said, Oh Krishna, you are ever doing good for the world, therefore it is right that you should bless me with the eyes to see your form, O best of the Yadavas. I pray for the sight to see you. O Kuru leader, let your eyes have sight, Krishna replied. And immediately Dhritarashtra could see him standing within the great hall. He also saw numerous gods approaching Krishna and worshipping him with Vedic mantras. Outside the hall, a fierce wind blew. Huge waves moved over the ocean, and thunderclaps reverberated in the sky. The earth trembled. The hall was in a tumult. Krishna withdrew his mystic form and again assumed a two-armed form. Taking permission from the rishis, he left the hall, holding the hands of Satyaki and Kritavarma. The rishis, headed by Narada, rose from their seats and vanished, their minds astonished. Dhritarashtra again became blind, and he sat in silent amazement. As Krishna left, the Kurus followed him with folded hands, like the gods following Indra. Only Duryodhana and his ministers remained seated. They were struck with wonder and unable to do or say anything. Their plan to capture Krishna was obviously futile. So that's before the battle of Kurukshetra took place. It's Krishna's, the occasion of Krishna's attempt to bring peace. Now, Krishna is all powerful. Why his attempt was not successful? He doesn't interfere with the free will of the living entity, just like Krishna wants us to surrender to him. Sarva dharmam parityaja mamekam sharanam braja aham tvam sarva papebhyo moksha yashami ma suchaha. Krishna requests of us, surrender unto me. So Krishna is unlimited and all powerful. How come it doesn't happen? Because there's a free will factor involved. That's our own free will, and we can say yes or no or maybe. Or 5%, 10%, maybe 50%, then again 5%, then again 3%, and then again. Oh, we're all over the place. And Krishna doesn't interfere, but he still offers his appeal to us to please surrender, because it's for our own good. So he came with an appeal to Duryodhana, but Duryodhana said no. So we should voluntarily accept Krishna's instruction. And elsewhere in Bhagavad Gita, besides in this 11th chapter where Arjuna is appealing to Krishna to reveal his form, he's seeing his two-armed form, but to reveal his universal form, it's descending mercy. And it's only by, so the emphasis that Prabhupada is making in the purport is only by devotion that Krishna says, I reveal myself to my devotee, and he reserves the right to not reveal himself to his, to the non-devotee. Sometimes people would ask Prabhupada, Swamiji, can you show me God? And Prabhupada said, do you have the eyes to see him? Well, if you're a qualified spiritual master, then you can give me the eyes to see him. Okay. The eyes to see him comes from your surrendering to Krishna. Are you ready? So Krishna reserves the right. Naham prakasha sarvasya yogamaya samavrata. Mudhoyam nabhi janati. He reserves the right to not disclose himself. But he also reserves the right to disclose himself. And in this chapter, he's going to disclose himself in his universal form, as he did to an unqualified person. But of course, the purpose was different. Krishna shows in this universal form the whole Kaurava army being destroyed. Before chronologically before it even happened, indicating that it was his intention. So all of these activities that took place, including Duryodhana thinking that he could capture Krishna and so forth, it's all part of a display of Krishna's lila, because he knows before things happen what's going to happen. He came to the assembly requesting peace, knowing that the answer would be no. But the righteous persons then could clearly understand, both from Krishna's words and from what all of the other wise, saintly persons were saying. Narada also spoke in that assembly. You know, just Duryodhana was incorrigible. It got to be the point where the only thing that was left was to have him arrested. But Dhritarashtra was the one to call for that to happen, and he wasn't doing that. So even an unqualified person can see if Krishna shows, if he chooses to disclose. But it's not that because one is a very learned person or pious person or a demanding person, Krishna's going to have to do something like show himself because somebody stamped a little foot and said, show yourself. Not like that. And the last point is that in the verse, manyase yadi tach chakyam. Chakyam is from the Sanskrit word shakti or shakyam. One is enabled to do things. Krishna, if you enable me to see your universal form, please show that form. There was a translation, something like, if you give the eyes to see me, can you give me the eyes to see your universal form? Krishna does that by his mystic, his yogeshwara, his being the Ishwara of yoga, mystic power. So this is the universe, and it's all of its details are a bit mystical. Prabhupada describes that the human being has very simple mystic powers. Mystic powers is defying the ordinary course of the laws of nature. Two examples he gives is our fingernails. It's a mystic power. Because there's no explanation of where bone grows from flesh. Just somewhere, just starts to grow. And we even have to cut them. But how does it happen? It's Prabhupada describes, it's mystic power. And I was just listening today, hearing Prabhupada describe when he was small, growing up, there was a yogi that regularly visited his father's house. And the yogi could do all kinds of things. He would describe how he did all kinds of things. In the course of one morning, he'd be in Haridwar and Rameshwaram and the mouth of the Ganga by Calcutta in Bengal, all within a period of an hour. By mystic power, he'd enter into the Ganga or to the water and transfer himself by mystic power, then take holy sacred bath in different places. We can't do those things, but they can do those things. But it's we can do those things in a slower time. We can do things as it's described in Nectar of Devotion. These are material things that can be, by manipulation of subtle material laws, one can do subtle material things. If you can't manipulate the subtle material laws, you do them by gross material laws. You do them grossly. But they still remain on the material platform. So Krishna's manifesting of the universal form, it's a temporary form. But it's being manifested by his mystic power. We can't do, and mystic yogis can't do either. They can't manifest the universe. There's a mystic power where they can create a planet, a mystical planet, but they can't create a whole universe with lots of planets inside it. That they cannot do, because they're tiny, fragmental part of the Supreme, and he is Yogeshwara, so they can make a flying something. Like Kardama when he made a flying city. We can make a city, but we can't make a flying city by mantra and by mystic power. We can't do that. Yogis can do that. And Krishna can create the whole cosmic manifestation or the form of the entire creation all in one place, show events before they happen. It's all part of his mystic display. So, the theme, back again to the verse, Arjuna is recognizing the necessity of descending mercy from the all-merciful, all-powerful, to show for the tiny to see the unlimited, or even a portion of the unlimited, the universal form. Hare Krishna. See the Prabhupada ki. Any discussion? What'd you do to your hands? Cut them? Used for punching? Okay. Drum?
And from bike.
Ah. You had a little spill with your bicycle? Okay. Does it hurt? It did at the time, but now it's not. Okay. Did you cry? Okay. Anyone? Yes?
I have a question. I read Mahabharata a couple of weeks ago. I was reading in the war. Bhishma was one of the days he was performing the war very fiercely.
He was doing what? Performing the war fearfully?
Fiercely.
Fiercely.
And in that more, I read that he was trying to hurt both Krishna and Arjuna. Arjuna, of course, I understand. But I thought Bhishma revered Krishna and he knew.
Yes, he did. Yes, he did.
But why did he try to hurt him so fiercely?
It's not exactly he tried to hurt Krishna fiercely. Krishna stood in the way of the arrows that were being fired at Arjuna, and he received the arrows in his chest, and Arjuna was thinking, oh, this is terrible. My Lord is being the recipient of the arrows that are intended for me, because he's the chariot driver and he's out in the front, and Krishna's moving and catching the arrows. Because Krishna wanted to protect Arjuna. But so Arjuna felt bad, and Bhishma wanted, he made a vow. You know the whole story. He made a vow that he would destroy Arjuna, or Krishna would break his vow, which was he would not fight. So he was fighting, but you know, whether he's fighting against Krishna or Arjuna, he's fighting against one who's dear to Krishna. That's also not very nice. But he knew that he wouldn't be able to defeat, because Krishna would protect. Krishna would break his vow. And sure enough, Krishna broke his vow.
I read that part of it. That he carries the wheel of the chariot.
Yeah. So the previous part was, it's a long narration. Bhishma, from his early days as a young man, he took a vow that he would not marry and he would not become the king, so that his father, Santanu, could marry Satyavati. Correct? That vow he didn't break, because Bhishma never broke his vow. He even fought with Parashuram for the sake of not breaking his... And Parashuram was his, the one who received training and military skill from. He was his guru. And he fought with Parashuram for 28 days. And Parashuram couldn't defeat Bhishma.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Parashuram kills so many.
So many, they couldn't defeat Bhishma. So, there's more details, but Bhishma never broke his vow. Bhishma never broke his vow. But during the battle, Bhishma made a vow that Krishna, by tricks, forced Bhishma to break his vow. The five arrows, you know the story, right?
Yeah.
You don't know?
No.
Oh. One evening, Duryodhana said to the great general Bhishma, "You're our general. And you're not fighting to your full capacity because you have affection for the Pandavas. So because of your sentiments, you're not doing your Kshatriya duty. I challenge you. Use your Kshatriya skill. I will kill the five Pandavas with these five arrows. You take them, keep them in safekeeping. Give them to me in the morning, and by the end of the day, I'll destroy the five Pandavas. This is my vow. And I'm Bhishma, I never break my vow." So you know what happened, right?
Right.
Okay. So when the arrows were taken by Arjuna, then Bhishma said, "This is Krishna's doing. Krishna has made me break my vow, and I never break my vow. So I take another vow. I will destroy Arjuna before the end of the day, or Krishna will break his vow." But he knew Krishna would break his vow to protect his devotee, because he's Bhaktivatsala, and that's exactly what happened. And as soon as he saw Krishna break his vow, he dropped his weapons. Ah. And it was love. It wasn't enmity. It was love.
Yeah. When I was reading that part of the law, the way it's described in Mahabharata, it looked like Bhishma was not only fearful, he intended to be fearful. That's the way it was described.
It was purposeful. It was to get Krishna to break his vow. He wanted to see this wonderful quality of Krishna. It wasn't just get back, he made me break my vow, so I'm going to make him break his. That's what it sounded like. But it's love. So here's a little deeper understanding. Yes, Bhishma Dev had love for Krishna. He was a great devotee of Krishna. And he had, amongst the five rasas, he had servitorship as his rasa. Here's Shanta, there's Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya. Dasya, servitorship. So his primary rasa with Krishna was as a servant. So what does a servant want? They want whatever the master wants. What does the master want? He wants love. So a secondary rasa is chivalry. There's five primary, seven secondary rasas. So the secondary rasa for Bhishma in relation to Krishna was chivalry. So he gave Krishna a good fight. Krishna loved it. Yeah. It's rasa.
I was reading all the way into the morning, 3 a.m. Because it's hot and it's described so well.
And now you know what happened. Okay. Anything else?
I have a question.
Yes, you have a question.
You just discussed that Krishna has the discretion whether to reveal himself to someone or not. So
that's right.
So he revealed to Dhritarashtra, but as our general understanding, that Dhritarashtra has a lot of ambitions and envious qualities.
Krishna is very kind. Krishna isn't bound. He reserves the right not to, but he also reserves the right to.
Yeah, I understand that one, but my question is, we never see anything that Dhritarashtra showed that he had pride. So that pride...
No, he was attached. He had a different kind of problem.
Is that the pride?
Well, he wanted to be king.
I mean, that is his ambition.
Yeah, that's pride too, you know. King. They just don't recognize it. I should be king. He had Kshatriya spirit. And that blinded his virtue. It's not that it's not that your mind is going. I can see. It's not that only pride is something that brings one down. But that's an essence. Well, you find pride in people that are ambitious too. They think I can do it. I'm powerful. I deserve it. I'm good. Something. Pride will be there also in an ambitious person. Not, you know, it's not compartmentalized. If you have ambition, you don't have any pride. If you have pride, you don't have any ambition. Okay, anything else? Yes? Many reasons. Love. To satisfy his devotee, Yudhisthira. Because Yudhisthira didn't know. But Krishna knew. So Krishna made like he didn't know. And Krishna liked taking the position of subordinate to Yudhisthira. He liked being the messenger of his devotee, Yudhisthira. He liked the opportunity to see Vidura and so many other nice things, to bring the great sages together for this momentous occasion, where it worked out terribly. But they had a chance to see Krishna, and Krishna had a chance to see them. Many things when Krishna does things. Those that were on the fence, they moved. Meaning, they weren't sure whether they should be on this side or that side. They were moved by Krishna's presence. So it showed also, it showed the world that the Pandavas weren't anxious for position. Just take the whole thing. They even said specifically, we will fight. Krishna said, they will fight on your side. You'll be the emperor. There'll be little kings down here. And them and all their armies will, with their full valor, fight on your behalf. They'll be subservient to you. Duryodhana's reply was essentially, I can't live on the same planet with those people. It's them or me. There'll be war. But so, up to the last straw, effort is made to make a peaceful solution. It shows by example. Supposing, just now we leave Mahabharata and we're in the real world. And we're dealing with a situation. Not just for public opinion, but to leave the option open. At least you gave your, you tried. You gave your full effort for some peaceful solution to a situation. It's commonly done like that in law. when somebody very clearly done something wrong, and they're saying, I didn't do anything wrong, they give them a plea bargain opportunity, you know, before there's a trial. Anyway, it's just like that. If you're in a conflict situation and it's very clear to you the consequences of moving forward, but you have to move forward because it needs to be done, you extend an olive branch to see if there can be a peaceful solution. Krishna is showing us by example. Even you may know the outcome, you do that anyway. Yes?
Yeah. Why did Krishna show the Rashtra his universal form? Because he was not a pure soul, right?
That's right. That question was over here. Yeah. Similar question, right? That was your question. Why? Well, Krishna was being kind. Yeah, well, it's like, you know, why did Vidura, after he became an Uttama Adhikari, topmost Vaishnav, go back to the royal palace to help his brother? And it was demonstrated that although he was attached, he was actually a great person. Beneath or behind all of those things that he just silently permitted, by his silence he was allowing Duryodhana to do his nefarious deeds. But he wasn't ready to put his foot down. He said in that assembly, from the very beginning of my son's birth, it has been advised that I disregard him, because he would be the ruination of the royal family. But I couldn't do that. I'm not strong enough to do that. At that point he said, maybe Gandhari can come and convince him. I don't have the strength to do that. He was, by his silence, he permitted many things. You know, Duryodhana knew how to play on his father's sentiments. If you don't do what I say, I won't be able to live. I'll give up my life. Oh, I couldn't bear that you give up your life. So I'll remain silent. He was too attached. That was his fault. But behind the fault, he was an elevated person. So that's why Krishna had some. Why does Vishnu help Indra? He's the king of the demigods, king of heaven. As the king of heaven, he does some bad stuff, but in his heart, he's the devotee. So Vishnu helps him. There's other examples. Daksha, in the sixth canto of the Bhagavatam, he offers these wonderful prayers and Lord Vishnu comes riding on the back of Garuda and says, you please me very much by your austerities. He knows his heart. I know your heart. His heart's not pure. But he can show himself even to such a person who later turns around and offends Narada Muni. Hey, don't do that. You just erase it. Okay? Krishna can do whatever he likes. And he does. He's not bound by some rule, oh, I can't show myself to Dhritarashtra because he has impure things. Okay, yes. Hare Krishna.
You mentioned that pride and ambition and pride are compatible. I mean, they're compatible.
They're very compatible. Yes.
Most of us, like who are devotees and who are aspiring devotees, when we are in this material world, we have a lot of ambition. Like, we want our kids to have a good education, go to the best school, we want a good job for us, and all this. So would you call that as right, or and how do we deal with them?
You called it by the right name. Ambition, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Now, give it a broader title and just, you know, wanting to be an enjoyer. And vicariously wanting our children to be enjoyers. So being, you know, very, very successful in the rat race. It depends on, largely, you know, just to give a blanket answer, it depends on the consciousness behind those activities. But commonly, unless one is a pure devotee, it's largely material ambition. Now, you know, there's some other things in there where one has some desire to see that our children have a nice life and they have what they need and all those things. Those are largely euphemisms, nice sounding, but the real thing is, you know, enjoyment, and pass on my sense of enjoyment to my children. And, you know, in a sense of pride, you know, they're successful. They get good grades and they get into good schools and on and on and on. It's that kind of thing, largely. And there's a price for that. You know, one of the prices is the real purpose of education is, using Prabhupada's term, development of character. And that's not what comes in public schools or private schools or higher education. That's not what is being transmitted. In fact, you know, there's a lot of concern about erosion of whatever character the parents may have imparted in that competitive environment, where there's, you know, all kinds of things rule rather than purity. Parenting is a major topic, so I don't want to go off into that right now. We'll have another class on that sometime. Yes.
Guruvaj, at the end of the 10th chapter, Krishna says that, you know, with a single fragment I sustain the universe.
Yes.
And then in the 11th chapter, Arjuna says, I want to see. But what Krishna actually shows him, a form by which he is annihilating the universe, by which he devouring the universe. So,
with both. Developing and devouring. The universal form does it all. One-stop shopping. Want a little developing? Here's some. Want a little devouring? There's some. It's all. It's the universe. It does brings things, maintains and destroys things. But the whole show is temporary. It's all of it. Okay. Yes. Hare Krishna. Hare
Krishna.
Right.
What was Dronacharya's ties to the
world? What was Dronacharya's reason? Similar to Bhishma Dev's, it was a bad choice. There's a religious principle, a dharmic principle, that says if you are maintained as they were maintained by the royal family, then there's an obligation. On behalf of the royal family, when the royal family has some confrontation, to at least in principle take the side of those who are maintaining you. Vidura was similarly maintained, but when he was insulted by Duryodhana, he left. But when he left, it's described, he placed by the door his bow and arrows, signifying, I'm not going to take part in this battle. And he was relieved, in one sense, that he wouldn't have to make that decision, because he too was maintained. Now, he wouldn't have. He was very outspoken. He wouldn't have, but it would have been difficult. So now it was just made easy. I don't have to fight on their side.
Could Dronacharya have had that option?
Yes, we always have options. And Drona would also have had an option. But he didn't. He followed that. So when there's principles of Dharma that are to be followed, not always but often, there are other principles of Dharma that are also to be followed that are in conflict with the one that's to be followed. And what are you supposed to do? On the one hand, but on the other hand. You follow what I'm saying? Should I give an example? A nice example comes in the 7th chapter of the 1st canto. No. Yeah, 7th chapter. Where Ashvatthama beheads the sleeping sons of the Pandavas. In the middle of the night, they're boys. He comes and cuts their head off. All 5 of them. Brahmin. Bring the heads to Duryodhana. It says here, the descendants of the Pandavas are now zero. Because Abhimanyu has already been killed. And here's the other sons, their heads. And even Duryodhana was disgusted. Get out of here. And he realized he made a big mistake. And when Arjun came to know that what had happened, he took a vow before Draupadi, I'll bring Ashvatthama, and as you're performing the oblations into the funeral, into the fire of your sons, you can stand on his head. So he brought him back. Long story. Brought him back with sword raised, and Draupadi said, don't kill him. And Yudhisthira, his elder brother, who he would never act in contradiction to, said, she's right, don't kill him. Bhishma Dev said, kill him. And Krishna said, you should kill him. So here he has these, you know, kill him, don't kill him. And Krishna gave reasons. He said, if you think there's some wrongdoing for killing a Brahmana, Brahma Hatya, don't worry. What he did was not Brahmana. He was Brahmana, he's Brahma Bandhu. He's lost his status as a Brahmana, so killing him won't be a sinful act. You can kill him. What to do? So what he did was he prayed to Krishna. And from within, Krishna gave him the intelligence how to do both, kill him, not kill him. Right? He didn't cut off his head, he cut off all of his hair except little patches and then sent him on, you know, banishment. Ashvatthama. Because for one who has once been honored, dishonor is worse than death. It was worse than killing him without killing him. And in the commentary, Prabhupada said what Krishna wanted to do was to show the world, just see what upholder of Dharma is Arjuna. He knows what Krishna wants. Even Krishna was saying, kill him. He knew what Krishna wanted. We're not like that. We can't imitate. But that's Arjuna's status. Or another example is in the yaksha who comes out of the lake in Mahabharata. And he asks Yudhisthira a number of questions, and one of them is a question similar to what you just asked. And Yaksha is Yamaraj asking his son, Yudhisthira, within the laws of Dharma, there are dharmas that are sometimes in conflict with one another, and how do you decide what to do? commonly what's done is you place the higher one above the lesser one. And you accept the higher one because the higher one is the higher one. Like what Krishna says in the 1866 Bhagavad Gita. The lesser ones, Prityaja. The topmost one, do that one. Mam ekam sharanam. And the other ones are lesser than that one. They're subordinate to this one. And actually they're pursuant to this one. So of all principles of Dharma, do that one. Okay? Okay. It's a happy group this evening. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.
Very nice.